Welcome back to the Commercial Real Estate Library Podcast. I'm Dama Tamanawala, you know, my co-host, Garrett McGillivray. And joining us today is the founder of Anthem Properties, Eric Carlson. Thank you for being here.
It is my pleasure to be here.
Awesome. A little about you guys. So I've got some high-level stats just so the audience can, we can bring them up to speed, especially we got a lot of Toronto listeners. 20,000 homes, 9 million in commercial space, constructed, owned, right? Yeah. Mix of office, industrial.
Yeah. And retail.
And retail, 8,500 acres of land owned, developed on, the whole...
In the pipeline. We add it up. We make the numbers as big as we can.
Yeah.
But they're generally true, you know, with plus or minus 5%.
Yes.
Round up.
Yeah. I'm a developer. Of course I do.
Yeah.
Right? Like round down.
Yeah. No, definitely not.
You get to the public hearing. You got to get the pro forma to work, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And assets in, you guys are active in Edmonton, Calgary, Sacramento, Vancouver, right?
Yes. And Toronto. This is quite recent. We just opened an office here. It's huge. It's got one employee and 1,400 square feet.
So. Wow.
Yeah. So we're
room to grow.
Yeah. Room to grow to eight people, right? So, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Well, we're here during the real estate forum in December, and I've been coming here for decades to, you know, beg for money and or go to a forum, and I thought, this is like center ice. This is where all the capital is. Some of the, like, I would say this, the smartest real estate people in the country generally are here, right? Mm-hmm. So you kind of got to be here. If you're a serious real estate player, you should have a Toronto presence. I mean, I don't really mean that to the world, but to me, I said that to myself. Yeah. So here we are. Yeah. So we're going to, you know, crawl, walk, run here.
So I don't mean
hoping to buy a house by the end of the year, you know, something like that.
Really?
You know, not for me to live here, no, to rent out, you know. So,
okay.
Yeah. A small asset was my point, you know.
Put down
get part of the boom.
Yeah. Put down a little bit. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But the core strategy is not go after Toronto real estate yet.
No. The core strategy is just to describe the company in a little bit more detail. Yeah. That's high level. So we founded in 1991. So, you know, you layer on, you grow a bit each year, it adds up, right? And so that's why those numbers are what they are. But I mean, compared to large companies, you know, it's still not much, you know, but we're motivated and we like to do lots of different things. So we're a very diverse company. You know, we like diversification. We like it on the asset side of the balance sheet. We like it geographically. We like it with respect to sources of capital. We like it with respect to the people that work at our company, right? Like, we share values in common as people, but, you know, if you have individual ways of thinking, three people can get in a room, assuming they're not working from home. That's a whole other kettle of fish. And and they can, you know, exchange views and you come up with better ideas, right? So, and then on the asset side, you know, it's great. Like, different markets do different things at different times. Different asset classes do different things at different times.
Yeah.
So something's always working. So 5 years into a diversified real estate strategy, you realize something else. Something is always not working as well, right? So you're always managing something that's going, and you're managing way out of issues. Not always, because sometimes the whole world works, but and sometimes the whole world doesn't work, but not for very long.
Right.
So we really like being able to do these different things. What we found is that by having a common platform of systems, processes, and culture, those can apply to any asset class, you know, a real estate culture, a vibrant organizational culture, you know, a learning culture. But then, you know, you start specializing in how do you build a concrete high rise versus a wood frame apartment building versus a steel frame, you know, shopping center. public hearing, you know, the political approval process is the same in every city. It's the same mayor. I was going to put in a little something in front of like the same like dickhead mayor or the same great mayor. It depends on the city.
Right? Yeah.
And so all those things that real estate has in common, you can share across a single platform and then specialize within that. And then you have a lot of fun because, you know, you can build high rises and then instead of doing single point towers, you can put something in the bottom of the podium, like some retail, create some vibrancy, do multi-phase projects. And, you know, by taking our retail capability we had, for example, with the rental business, which we turned into the condo business, which was good at the time and then ended up being stupid afterwards. But anyway, you can create great urban places, right? And then it's more fun, but also it gives you something better to lease or to sell, right? So diversification is key, you know, and that's why we're in those different cities. And just to explain that in a little more detail, we don't do absolutely everything from soup to nuts. And I like to think that within any asset class, we're pretty disciplined. So we have three groups: vertical development, land and house mm-hmm. building, and then investment portfolio. And back to vertical, within that you have high rise, low rise, and commercial. And the commercial we develop is mostly food anchored retail, and more warehouses, like industrial properties, some business parks. And then on the land and house building, that's where your community, suburban community development, you buy like a quarter section of land from a farmer after spending 3 years drinking 18,000 cups of shitty coffee with them and developing a rapport. And then you take it through the approval process for like years, and then you put in sewer pipes and roads, and you build lots, and you know, you sell the lots to builders. Sometimes you sell them to yourself to build houses. Sometimes you sell some to yourself to build a shopping center to anchor the community. That's a great business, right? And then you've just said an investment portfolio, almost done.
Okay.
You got like, that's where our food anchor retail is. We say retail and office. To be clear, we don't do office really. Those are the dentist office and the chiropractors that are tacked onto the end or on the second floor of a pad. And then we have, and that's a whole fluke that we're not into the downtown stuff. Again, that's another kettle of fish, right?
It's not doing great.
Yeah, no, and that's like, there for the grace of God, go I. It sort of rings in my head a little bit. And we got an emerging sort of multifamily rental portfolio. So we shift from condos back to rental. And then that's where we try to accumulate warehouses and industrial rents. So three little business units within the investment portfolio. You add that up, that's like a lot of overhead. That's 535 people. One of the best accounting systems known to man. We love accounting in my company. You got to keep track of what you're doing. You can't just add up invoices at the end of the job
right.
and hope you made money. You got to sort of do it every day, every week, every month, for years. You know, make sure you've got it all added up, right? So we love accountants and financial analysts. It's huge. But really what I like, salespeople and leasing people, because without revenue, you got nothing to account for, right? So
beautiful. But why don't we put it right at the beginning of the episode? Is there anything you want to draw attention to right now? We got a lot of broker listeners.
Yeah, about industry going and the markets in general, and then there's what Anthem's doing about it. So just high level, like it's not the best year. Last year, second half of 2022, first half of 2020, not the best year to be a broker, right? Good thing about being old is you've been around a little bit. I can say that now. I used to pretend, like when I started the company, I used to pretend to be 50 when I was like 30. Mm-hmm. That's hard to pull off because I looked like I was 12, right? But at some point, you do get older and you experience stuff. So I started in this business in 1982. Prime rate was 23%. You know, a real estate deal, they just didn't happen. The industry was bankrupt, right? Like, so actually, I became an accountant. That's why I like accountants.
Okay.
Yeah. It was the only job I could get, right? You know, like, the audit, they look backwards. Go, yeah, it was a good year. Man, it wasn't a good year. Oh, you can't say that on your program. You can edit that out, right? But it was like you had to, I needed a job, right? So
you were born and raised in Vancouver.
Yeah, well, North End. You know, there's a clear distinction.
Yeah, Vancouver's
where all the feats live, and North End's where all the real people live.
Okay. Mountain biking,
and, you know, skiing and stuff like that. So I love the North Shore. Except my mother lived there, so I had to leave for a while. But, you know, we made things right. Yeah,
in
the end. Yeah. She made me play in a band, right? Like, you know, you go. Right. Not a rock band. I do that on my own, right? You may play like in an orchestra, right? And play percussion, right? It was just like a triangle.
No.
A bass drum, a snare drum. It's not all at the same time like it is in jazz and rock. So I didn't like that. So the good news was the orchestra leader said, well, you know, I do have a shortage of tuba players. So I've talked to your mother and we've agreed you're going to play the sousaphone.
Oh my God.
So when I was 12, I looked like I was 5. And to pick up on that theme. And so I had to carry a 45-pound sousaphone, like in parades and stuff like that. It was, four notes. So like even I could figure out how to play it, right? But it was a tough go. I had a tough childhood, just from that perspective. But in all seriousness, I had a phenomenal childhood. Growing up in North Bend, in my era, was like awesome, right? Like it was sort of like, you guys are too young to remember the show Leave It to Beaver. You ever see it on syndicated TV?
My dad has shown that to me.
Yeah. Like that's the kind of how I thought my life was, right? You know, you come home, there's mom and dad, and there's liver and boiled potatoes and green beans, you know, for dinner. But it's okay.
God.
You have HP sauce and ketchup, right?
Right.
Yeah. That was an era of bad cooking. It was Betty Crocker cookbooks, right? Like they sort of was post-World War II era. You know, it was like everyone was sort of like, processed food's actually a luxury, so it's a special treat to have fake cheese and powdered milk and crap like that.
Milk with dinner.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. So don't you guys do that?
No.
What do you have with dinner? Drink like pop.
You know, athletic you're greens, old now. Wine, multivitamins.
Multivitamin water. Yeah, great. Yeah, I'll take the milk. So it's real estate we're talking about, right?
Yeah, yeah. So it was 1982, you were an accountant.
Yeah, so I'm saying to the industry and to people like that are sort of in your space, you know, where you're getting paid contingently for delivering results. When people get paralyzed, they don't move. It's hard to do deals, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, I think that for a long time, post 9/11, when we started the era of permanently printing money and quantitative easing, we got away with asset prices going up, but having no inflation to keep interest rates low because globalization really mm-hmm. helped to keep, you know, open up supply chains, technology innovation. I mean, you know, first calculator I bought was in 1974 was $150.
My God.
You get that stuff for free with a box of cereal, right? So that helped keep inflation in check. So we kind of got away with something, which was everything was good. And if you're in the hard asset business, that was the stuff that inflated. And so the velocity of deals went up and there's all this, you know, fluid money. So I think that the younger generation got used to, like, yeah, you get a listing, you sell it. It's a 30-day look, 30-day close, unless it's faster. And
yeah,
and you
offers,
get it. Yeah.
No problem.
In my day, I remember Strawberry Hill Shopping Center in Surrey, British Columbia, being listed by my old buddy, Bob Levine, who's not at Colliers. He's at Avison, prior to that, Knowlton. Really old guys remember those firms, Knowlton. And he's a very good advisor. And he had that thing listed, tied up like five times. It was on the market for 18 months. And in the end, it didn't sell. He lost the listing. You know, and how hard did he work to not sell that thing? You know, like, and that was pretty common, you know. Like, it was a big party when somebody removed subjects. Because, A, not only do you make money, you actually you're about to get a deal done, right? So we were kind of in that era. We're just not used to it. The market's kind of forgotten about it. I was talking to some of the capital markets guys here. And they had a party for 20 years, right? And they're sort of like, party's over, right? And so now what do you do? Well, I mean, you go back to fundamentals. People still occupy space. You have to look at the big picture. You've got to think about, you know, what your purpose and what drives you as an individual, what drives you as a company, and this too shall pass. The good thing about capitalism, to the extent we still have it, which I'll avoid the socialist rabbit hole and how the world's going to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah.
The good thing about free markets is they adjust, you know, and they adjust to clear, right? So if mm-hmm. you have excess supply or excess demand, something will happen to right size it in due course. You know, I don't think we're in a really, really bad place. It seems like it compared to where we were. Interest rates have never been this high. Well, never this high in like years.
Right.
But in decades, they're still quite low
mm-hmm.
when you have that perspective. And I look at our pro formas and our jobs. You know, higher interest rates are a drag for sure. Like, I mean, interest costs are higher. It affects consumer behavior. People go, oh my goodness, interest rates are high and there's inflation. There's going to be a recession. My God, and they freeze. They don't buy the house. They don't,
mm-hmm.
they don't expand and rent the new store space or take on the new distribution space that they hesitate. I think that's the bigger cost of rising interest rates. But these interest rates are a level that are still workable. They're not catastrophic. I mean, cap rates are creeping up a bit. You know, how much more will they creep up? I don't know. Not much. Will they creep down a bit? Maybe a little bit. Maybe we're going to a new normal where interest rates are higher than they've been for the last 10 years, you know, and mm-hmm. especially the last two. I mean, that was like a freebie. Like the idea that was normal is ridiculous, right? So I think that, you know, interest rates are going to, you know, come down a bit in due course, probably first quarter of 2024. It depends on what bank economists you listen to and what month, right? But sometime in the not too distant future, they'll moderate. They're not going back to where they were. Go down a bit.
Do you think we're just going to take off at that point?
That we're going to take off?
Yes.
No. No, take off. The whole boom bust thing, that's for the media, right? It's either really hard or it's normal. And sometimes it feels really good. But really, most of the time it's normal. But as soon as it adjusts a bit, we're in a culture of, you know, sensationalism. And,
yeah.
and so it's like, oh, it's a boom. Apparently Calgary's booming right now. It isn't. You know, like, ask anyone who owns an office building if it's booming in Calgary, right? It's growing again. Hey, hallelujah, it's growing again. After hitting your head against the wall for 6 freaking years, it feels fantastic. But that's because you're not hitting your head against the wall anymore.
Right.
That's not a boom. We're going to a kind of a normal market. So, you know, we have, you know, sold a bunch of lots last year. Our builders sold a bunch of houses, especially in Calgary. Edmonton's still pretty soft, right? Like, office market's like way oversupplied. You know, distribution space is working because it's so expensive elsewhere in the country, in Ontario, especially in Vancouver. You know, so it, but I like to call it, it's like kind of normal. Like it's going to a market that's somewhat reliable, you know, depending on the asset class you're in. That's great, but that's not coming back hard or coming back fast. I think we'll go to a place where all the people in the world who are scared because of what they're reading in the media or because of how they feel about interest rates or their own personal situations, because mm-hmm. rising interest rates, it is hard, especially right. if you're over-leveraged, right? Which we never are. We are just right. You know, we love leverage, but just the right amount, right? Like, those, there is hardship for sure. And there will be some financial distress we're seeing in the banking sector of the United States. It's not an epidemic. It's not bank contagion. It's like if you're a regional bank and you invested in bonds instead of getting deposits, right, or whatever, and hedging right. properly, you got killed when the bond market went down, and you know, or the rates went up and the value of your assets went down, right?
Can you see any sort of like black swan, anything that cracks into the Canadian market and affects us in some way?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about black swans is nobody sees them coming, right? And then when after they come, they said, well, of course, and you get these pundits, especially with that capital economics group, they're always so negative. It was like, we've been predicting this for years. Well, if you predict black swan events every quarter for 10 years, eventually you'll be right.
Yeah, right.
But you're wrong most of the time and people stop listening to you, right? So will there be a black swan event? I don't think so. But I didn't think there was going to be one in 2022 because I didn't think Putin would be stupid enough and vain enough to invade Ukraine.
Right.
Whatever your perspective is on that, I can't believe the conspiracy theories in that, but that's a whole other discussion that was the real estate conversation.
Yes.
Except that stuff like that comes back to affect, you know, the world and public policy and the economy and fiscal policy and monetary policy, which really affects real estate, affects all business, right? So all these esoteric things that happen are actually very important to think about. So when you think about black swan events, you don't think about something that happens to the real estate industry. You think about what's going to happen in the world that's going to mess things up or make things way better. We'll call those, I don't know, what's the opposite of black swan event?
White swan.
Okay, swan. One of those. A swan
white
event.
White swan.
A beautiful swan. Like when the pandemic happened, I thought the world was going to end for about a week. I just thought, this is really bad. You know, I woke up and said, work for a billion people down the tubes. And we're going to take everybody with us, right? And then it kind of, you know, moderated a bit and we kind of found a way to work from, thank goodness for, was it Skype in the beginning before it turned into Teams
and Zoom and stuff?
And we could kind of make, you know, which has all these other sort of boiled frog issues, which we'll probably get to in a bit, this whole work from home thing. But back to the box one thing. I don't think so, right? Okay. I think that people are resilient. You know, like there's a lot of people who suck in the world. We can look at those people, they're high profile, and you go, this is really depressing.
Yeah.
But there's way, 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 way more people who are phenomenal, who can think clearly and lead and innovate. And those people, if you leave them alone, they'll rise up. If you keep telling them what to do, they won't, you know. But I think that we're already adjusting, right? Like, so if you go forward, what could make things worse? Like a nuclear bomb getting lobbed in Kiev, you know, that wouldn't
be great.
That would be not good.
China
saying, hey, it's never been better to go grab Taiwan, you know, you know, those types of things would really wreck what we're going to recover to. I don't think that's going to happen. Right.
What about the white swan event? Like when you think about, if there is no black swan, then things are just as normal. Then how do you think about your diversified strategy?
Yeah. Well, I don't think there's going to be some sort of new thing that quickly just bounces back. You know, I think you gradually work your way out of these things. You're in a current, you guys are too young. You used to swim side stroke when you took swimming lessons in addition to the other strokes. You swim side stroke out of the raging river with the current, right? You don't fight it too hard.
Right.
I really think that's a good metaphor for how you get out of economic malaise. If government can settle down a bit, apply a little bit of industrial policy leadership, which isn't going to happen in Canada today, but a little bit of that, you know, the fiscal policy doesn't work against monetary policy. I mean, it's nuts if you're trying to tame inflation, now the government double down on expenditures. If government can sort of get its act together, if it can coordinate the provinces, if it can create some sort of a framework for like a national housing policy that's bought into by the world, if we start doing things like that, and then you leave entrepreneurs alone to do their own thing and markets alone to their own thing, they'll work their way out of it. We'll find a way to balance, right? But and just on that note, we are still unbalanced, like in the housing market. You know, they call it the housing crisis.
Yeah, always.
Okay, we've had a housing crisis since, like, I don't know, 1867, right? Like, we have more people coming here. We have homes. We have to figure out how to build them. And there have been times in history where everything's working. Like, after World War II, it was working because everyone worked together to build a shit ton of houses for people coming home from the war.
Right.
And for a world that was recovering and starting to grow again, and then for the ensuing baby boom. And now we don't have that. We have kind of, I would say, on the public side, complete dysfunction. You know, you have there's no national policy. There's no federal policy of, like, hey, if we're going to have 400,000 or 500,000 immigrants a year and 100,000 students coming to the country and only so many dying, we're going to be shortage of housing. So what are we going to do we're going to work with the provincial housing minister, figure out what their policies are. Then we're going to work with the local development communities, and we're going to figure out a way to speed up the approval process. Like in Vancouver, if you buy a site, we had a site that was fully zoned. To get the development permit took 3 years. It was all about, can you move the bricks over this way? How about granite? We don't like the red brick. How about granite? Can we do that? How about, you're almost finished? You know, the chief planner just showed up. We really think this having that townhouse in the corner, it'd be nice if it was a coffee shop. Go back 8 months and start over again. We're finished. You know, now that we're here, traffic's a bit higher over on First Street. How about a traffic loop? How about you pay for that? You know, how do you build housing when you have this dabbling interference coming at you from somebody 2 years out of planning school who has too much, with all due respect to some very good planners out there, but
I feel
there,
like
has to be a framework. There has to be a framework where you say the job is to get the housing built. Really, that's job one.
Yeah.
Your ego's got to go over here. Sorry.
Do you think that can come from the top down? Like, you're a big
Totally. Trudeau absolutely.
Guy, right? So,
absolutely. If I was the prime minister, we wouldn't have a housing crisis. You know, like, I don't think we would. If John Love was the prime minister, you wouldn't have a housing crisis. You know,
I agree.
You have people who are motivated, who know how to run an organization, who can link strategy to execution. Those people can get stuff done. And I think at the political level these days, largely because of ourselves, the electors, you know, we vote for good looks, we vote for popularity, we vote for with the feel good moment of the at that time and when they're in the ballot box, as opposed to thinking cohesively about our principles, our values, our personal visions, what public policy platform is going to get us to that vision better, faster, having rational discussions instead of these insane troll debates and all.
And that's what it is, right? It is that sensationalism too.
Yeah, that gets them votes.
Yeah,
and that's what, like, I watched a chat from Benjamin Tall the other day. And
yeah.
He was talking about how something like 60% of people get their economy news from social media.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's just headlines.
Yeah. Right? RT Now, which was this Russian news propaganda channel that a lot of Canadians listen to and think that's the truth, right? Like, it's there's that disruption, you know, from social media for sure. But getting back to leadership, if we had strong leadership across the board in a strong federal cabinet and a provincial cabinet, and at a city government, and everyone was aligned on a common purpose, which is, let's build a lot of housing for everybody instead of, you know, picking on the rich people or the immigrants or, you know, that foreign buying thing. That's kind of a xenophobia, really, if you ask me. It's this myth that the housing market's distorted in Canada because too many rich people from Hong Kong or Singapore buy homes here, you know, and it's a... Really, we have a lot of immigrants. And so when you see people buying houses and they have accents, you know, it's not because they're foreigners dominating the market. It's because they're Canadians trying to get ahead. Mm-hmm. New Canadians, the kind that work their butts off to help drive the economy, right? And so you need good leaders would out that. And they would say, this is what's really going on. They wouldn't promote false narratives. They wouldn't create bad policy to counteract false narratives. And they would get on with things. Yeah, so, I mean, I think that's a huge issue for Western civilization, frankly, not just Canada. But I think that if that corrected itself, and that won't happen overnight, so that's not like this magic moment with White Swan thing.
Yeah.
That's a decision by us that we're not going to vote for shitty leaders anymore, and we're going to encourage good people who don't want to take on getting, you know, character assassinated in social media.
Yeah.
To then step up and step in. I think that would really help the world in every respect. And I think ultimately it would help the housing market and so on. So,
yeah. We'll see. I'm a little bit pessimistic on that front. I don't
on the leadership.
I don't see the voters voting in.
Yeah.
The leader. Yeah. Well, I mean, but I think that where that comes from is people like, okay, in this right now is talking about it. I mean, this is a real estate discussion. We're talking about, you know, federal leadership or global leadership or public policy. If you make it important by talking about it and putting shining a light on it, I think that Matt, I think then ultimately you'll win the day. Do you think the quality of interaction on social media is improving, or like on Twitter, is it getting better or worse?
Rapidly decaying.
It is.
Yeah. I think most people are just on, like, forget Twitter. It's TikTok. It's all the, like, 10-second soundbite.
Yeah.
That's it. I mean, I had trouble with those 170 characters on Twitter. I closed my Twitter account. I just didn't want to spend any time looking at it. I'd rather read a book. I'd rather have this conversation with you guys. You know, I'd rather think. The other thing, in addition to thinking about leadership and policy that we keep talking about, we could be thinking about basic stuff like philosophy and history. If you think about the essence of life and the purpose of life and the meaning of life, and you engage in those conversations that you could never do on TikTok in 10 seconds, you actually have to read a bunch of books and you have to engage in discussion. People used to
reflect.
Yeah, like book clubs, you know, and you go to university and join the debating society, you know, or whatever it is. People would see that, and when they'd read the newspaper, there was actually good journalism in it. You know, in the opinion column, there'd be the left side, and there'd be the right side. And,
right.
And so you could. I'm not saying it was perfect. There's a lot of stupidities around since the beginning of time, right? But if we can shine a light on thinking and shine a light on how to make the world better and get people invested in that and seeing the upside in that, I think people would be happier.
Yeah.
And I think we'll end up with better outcomes. And I think when people are given a choice between, you know, happiness and sort of pleasure, and they can see the difference, they'll pick happiness. Right? So anyway, that's that has nothing to do with industrial rents, does it?
No, but let's.